welcome to another episode of the Pedestrian Podcast, the official podcast of for the UK Seahawkers. This week we will go through everything which happened virtually last weekend for this year's NFL draft, and how what Seahawks came away with, how they look on the back end of the draft, and everything else going on in the Seattle Seahawks universe. Joining myself, Stuart Corp, and Adam Nathan, is our friend, Mr. Alistair Corp. How are we, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing well, thank you. Thanks for having me back. How are you doing?
Not too bad. How's quarantine lockdown treating you in your part of the world?
Oh, it's just splendid, you know. Everybody's close. Everybody close to me is healthy, so I got no complaints.
Yeah, that's all. As I guess it kind of gives you a bit more understanding for how much that does matter, doesn't it, when things you see what other people are going through, don't you?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's a good reminder of practicing some gratitude, right?
Yeah, for sure. So before we go into pick by pick, obviously it's slightly less important for that first question, I guess. But what's your overall feeling on the 2020 draft class for the Seahawks?
I think I don't really like to assign a grade to it, just as kind of arbitrary. Yeah. But if you're to do so, I think it's kind of coming in as a B. You know, I think it's pretty solid. They checked some boxes. They did some things in unusual manner, as is typical of them. But overall, it's hard to complain when I think they came away with a pass rusher who has a pretty high ceiling, and then kind of filled some other needs that they needed to fill. You know, they didn't necessarily do it in the exact way we expected, but they did it. So it's hard to complain. And they've proved time and time again to know what they're doing. So I'll show some patience, you know.
Yeah. So obviously the first surprise in inverted commas was the fact that they picked with their native pick at 27. Obviously, Shino said they tried to trade back with the Packers, who then traded up to 26 to get their quarterback of the future. But then the Seahawks took Texas Tech linebacker Jordan Brooks, who was someone who was slightly on my radar, but perhaps about half a round later, the initial reaction was somewhat surprised the fact that he was the guy at 27, but there seems to be, as I wrote in my little blog, that there seems to be like a succession plan with and for him in mind, doesn't that, with Jordan Brooks at 27?
Yeah, definitely. That's, I still have a little bit of an issue with maybe the value of the pick. But then, it's happened. He's a Seahawk now. So it's kind of like, let's get on with it. Let's analyze, what he's going to do. And when I started to kind of come around to that, yeah, it's definitely, like you said, a succession plan. I think in the long term, him and Cody Barton kind of project as a really nice tandem. I think they'll play well together. And in the short term, I think he'll be an improvement on Michael Kendricks. You know, I think a lot of people are going to groan thinking, oh my God, they're going to play three linebackers again. But if that's kind of the scheme they're going to move forward with, he'll be an improvement. He's going to make that team better being on the field. So, people are going to kind of have an issue with the pick itself, but I think he'll help them, and he'll help them within the division, which is great because, they've been competitive inside the division, but at the same time, the Niners have kind of run up and down on them. Even the Cardinals did, and then obviously the Rams have had their number. So if they can be a bit more competitive inside the division, it's just going to be kind of more fun to watch because, they've had the record stack up, but it just seems like, the other teams in the division have just, they've had their way with that defense in recent years. So it'll be nice to see some extra speed on the defense.
Yeah, that's the main thing, because with Kendricks and KJ Wright, for how well KJ played, the speed wasn't exactly, that's exactly what it was with obviously KJ and Kendricks last year. The speed wasn't top of the list of things they impress with, but that's the first thing that pops off when you watch him, when you watch Brooks, isn't it? Is that speed and how quickly, first and foremost, he gets downhill and gets to the ball, gets to the quarterback on a few occasions as well for Texas Tech. That speed is just as clear as anything, isn't it, with Brooks?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I mean, like you said, KJ Wright played really quite well last year. but I still thought there was kind of an argument to be made that maybe they would be better off cutting the Wright and moving forward with Barton next to Wagner, just because they needed that extra speed. Like, for all the good things that Wright does well, and he hides his lack of speed just because he's such a smart player. But at some point you do need some play speed on there. And you even saw in the time that Barton got on the field, kind of after Kendricks went down and in little spot starts there, like, his speed made a huge difference. If they're getting that from Brooks on, even if it's, you know, say 60% of the snaps next year, it'll make a noticeable difference. And that's everything. Cause the teams in the division will stretch you vertically and horizontally. Yeah. And they didn't have the speed to compete with it.
Yeah, there's been a few examples. I think Sam Gold has done a filming thing on Brooks, where there's been a few examples where he's able also to track tight ends or the slot receivers downfield and go step for step for him. I mean, that's something, again, which it's been a bugbear for the Seahawks. Well, for most of the time Pete Carroll's been in Seattle, it seems, there's always that no-name tight end who dominates the linebacker position for some reason for the Seahawks. But on the evidence we have of Brooks in college, he could also be an uptick in that way as well, couldn't he?
Yeah, definitely. And that area more than anything is where, you know, if you have faith in the Seahawks coaching staff's ability to develop linebackers, which I think you do, you know, even if you think nothing else of them, they've proven to be able to develop linebackers really well. And so if they can get Brooks to a place of even being just passable in coverage, I think he'll be a really solid starter, just because, like you mentioned, you know, his speed in the box, getting downhill, and then his ability as a blitzer is what is, like, the most exciting thing for me, at least as a rookie. That's where I think he'll make his biggest impact, and it'll make a really big difference. You know, if he ends up with 4 or 5 sacks next year, and then, you know, say 20, 25 pressures, like, that'll make a huge difference. That's like a presence they didn't have last year. So it'll be fantastic if they can get that out of him.
Yeah, so one thing everyone's talked about is things that we'll get onto a bit later is the pass rush. And so do you think Brooks is a different way of them addressing the pass rush, even in the short term, of him playing on the outside of the linebacker position? Then do you think it's a new approach to try and light a pass rush fire on the defensive side after last year?
I do, yeah. I actually, like, I kind of anticipated them doing something like that, but more so, you know, it was Zach Bond or Josh Uche, kind of somebody like that, who is more, he's closer to Bruce Irvin than Michael Kendricks, but Brooks is closer to Kendricks than Irvin. And I mean, so Kendricks last year rushed the passer on about 20% of his snaps. And, you know, he got, what, 3.5 sacks, but he didn't create much pressure. I think Brooks is a much more natural pass rusher. And then he's a really good blitzer. Like, his timing on blitzes, his disguise is really good. And so I think that he'll be productive there. And like you said, it'll be a way to kind of spark that a little bit more. You know, last year they were depending on kind of two guys to produce all of their sacks for them. This year they'll have, you know, I think they have 5, 6, as many as 7 guys who can, in theory, contribute. You know, obviously not everybody will, but at least they have more darts thrown at the dartboard this year, which I think is great, because last year was just awful to watch at times.
Yeah, it was not much fun, especially I was over for the Baltimore game, and it was just, after a while, it was just elementary. So after Brooks, they kept on the defensive side of the ball, and after they did it with Jaron Reed a few years ago, they did it with DK Metcalf, I believe, last year. The Seahawks traded up Alistair further up into the second round and got Daryl Taylor, a long, bendy pass rusher from Tennessee, who last year played all 13 games for the Tennessee Volunteers. With a stress fracture in his leg, which sounds firstly unwise, but secondly incredibly painful. First of all, were you surprised that they traded up at that point? And what are your thoughts on Taylor and his fit in the Seahawks again, the aided and adding to the pass rush in Seattle?
Yeah, you know, actually, I wasn't really that surprised necessarily. Ahead of kind of the Friday draft kicking off, I thought that maybe that's something that they would do, just because, you know, they still, at least at the time, I thought they still kind of had two holes that they needed to fill, and they needed to fill with a player who could help, like, year one. So seeing them move up wasn't a huge surprise there for Taylor. And then as far as the pick itself, I'm really excited about it. I think he's kind of, you know... I still bet on Rasheem Green's upside, so I wouldn't say that he's got the highest kind of upside of a player they've drafted recently, but he's right there with everybody else. Like you said, he's super bendy. He's kind of the ideal Leo. And then he's shown little bits and pieces of power. And I think, you know, he probably won't win with a bull rush consistently, but even if he can get to a point of converting speed to power, that'll just like further vary his pass rush moves. And it's just going to make him harder to game plan for. He's a guy that I'm really excited about the ceiling on him. I think he's a guy who can contribute right away, which is exciting. And then, you know, he might be able to contribute right away with, say, you know, 6-8 sacks as a rookie. But you're looking at a guy who's going to top double digits like consistently in the future, which, you know, they didn't really adequately replace Frank Clark a year ago. Mm-hmm. Now I think they have, which is awesome, because that makes it just so much easier to kind of build the roster moving forward, knowing that you have a Leo in place. It just makes it easier to get the talent around him.
Yeah, I think he said to the Seattle beat writers and journalists that he wants to win Defensive Rookie of the Year this season. So that's pretty lofty goals and pretty exciting as well. But I mean, Pete Carroll was kind of led down the path and given the answer, but Chris Clemens and Frank Clark were the immediate comparisons made for Taylor. That's kind of how he's going to fit, and that's the role, and people who may not be aware of him, that's kind of what you can expect to see from his game in Seattle for the next however many years, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, maybe the player itself isn't kind of a like for like, but as far as the role goes and kind of the importance on defense, it's right in line with that. You know, I think by Frank Clark's last season here, he was probably second, third most important player on the defense, depending if you're still counting Earl after he got hurt. But he's going to be exactly in line with that. And that's great, because I think they kind of have a cornerstone player in the secondary. They have theoretically a cornerstone player both for the future in terms of Jordan Brooks, and then also in the present with Wagner. And now they have that player on the defensive line in Daryl Taylor. They're starting to kind of rebuild the foundation, which is great, because I think they wasted a couple of years there as far as accumulating talent. So if they can get back on track, that's really needed. It's well overdue. So I'm really excited about Taylor's impact.
Yeah. So there's a lot of talk about more often other positions, obviously quarterback, and how learning different offenses. Obviously, we saw with Russell Wilson going from NC State to Wisconsin, and how that helped him adapt to the NFL. But obviously with Brooks and with Taylor, the 2018 season, they played slightly different positions, didn't they? Because, I mean, Taylor was more off the line and no hands in the dirt kind of thing, and Brooks was playing an outside role he's probably going to play, and then last year he was the guy in the center of that Texas Tech defense. I mean, that can only be a net positive for them transitioning to what may be a different role to what they did last year. But the role changes is something they're comfortable with and have a history with as well, isn't it? That can be a positive, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And like their positive traits in their game translated already from a position move. So I think that you nailed it in terms of it's going to help them moving forward. You know, the things that Brooks are good at will still apply, whether he's lining up at Sam or Mike or Will. And then same with Taylor, you know, the things are that he's really good at, turning the corner, finishing when he gets to the quarterback, those are going to be showing up. You know, he's going to be a Leo in Seattle, but if they played him off ball in kind of that Bruce Irvin Sam role from his first time around, I think you'd still see those pass rush traits show up. So their traits kind of had transcended positions already. And yeah, you nailed it. It'll help them, you know, wherever they line up, it'll kind of apply, which is good, because I think, you know, the traits of the player is what's selling them on it. So
yeah
I think they're going to make an immediate impact, which is great.
Yeah, then in the third round, towards the end of the second day of the draft, they made possibly could be my favorite pick of the lot. Damian Lewis, obviously in the week, Billions is back on Showtime this weekend. They take his namesake, who probably goes about his business slightly differently to what the guy who portrays Bobby Axelrod does. But I mean, again, in that thing I wrote about Succession, talked about how he's going to succeed DJ Fluker, but it also seems that's even more immediate than we probably anticipated it would be. But Damian Lewis is that in that DJ Fluker type mold, isn't he? He's going to run over people, but he's possibly got, the team clearly think he has a higher ceiling in other aspects of his game on the Seahawks airline, doesn't he?
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's something that's consistent across him and Phil Haynes. And then even if we want to extend it to like a free agent edition, BJ Finney, all three guys are like, they have actual upside as pass protectors, which is exciting because, you know, Fluker was a ton of fun to watch. He was an awesome run blocker, but, you know, somebody his size, you saw him kind of consistently get pushed back in pass protection, which shouldn't happen. You know, I don't think he was a very good pass blocker at any point. His first season there, he's kind of passable. Last year, he took a big step back. You know, Lewis isn't going to be immediately a really good pass protector, but he has the things that, you know, make you think that he could develop there. You know, he has the length, he has the anchor. So it just kind of comes together. You're looking at all of a sudden an interior line that can actually hold up and protect, which is kind of my immediate reaction was, I think the interior of the line matters a little bit more when it's in front of Russell Wilson, because we've seen interior pressure just absolutely derail him at times. Whereas, you know, edge pressure, he can kind of spin out or escape up the middle. So if they're going to build that thing kind of inside out, I think they're well on their way to having a pretty competent line, which I'll take at this point, you know?
Yeah, so obviously Damian Lewis went to LSU. Is that, I mean, probably more so this year than others, that playing against the best of the best, that's a big deal for the Seahawks, that they can, again, make that transition, especially in what is going to be quite a unique off-season summer program for these rookies. And the fact that he's got games against Bama in big time, prime time conditions, that's only going to help him, isn't it?
Yeah, and that's kind of consistent with this kind of new direction they're taking with offensive line selections. I mean, if you think about the guys they've drafted recently who are either like fairly high or fairly high profile, you know, you have Ethan Pochich, you have Jamarco Jones, and these are guys who played a ton of games in college at a big time program, came in with pedigree. And like Lewis is exactly in that line. And so, you know, if they're kind of starting to lean in that direction rather than taking a tight end from Eastern Kentucky like George Fant, not to say George Fant wasn't a good player there, but if all of a sudden they're going to target guys who, like, you don't need to project really with them. You know what they're going to be good at, and like, you've seen it already. You don't need to kind of think, oh, they have the athletic traits that could translate. Like, if that's where they're going with it, I'm really happy with that, because I'm kind of over this idea of trying to develop these raw molds of clay at offensive line. I'd much rather kind of sign guys who Solari thinks will fit what he needs to do and just let him move forward with it, because I think that's the way to get to a competent line, maybe even a good offensive line, which I mean, with how high powered that offense is, even a good offensive line, that would make it really scary, which would be awesome.
Day three, the Seahawks moved to the other side of the ball for four of their five selections on Saturday. Colby Parkinson, a tight end from Stanford, DJ Dallas, a running back from Miami, for second year running back from Miami. I can't remember his first name, the wide receiver from Florida, and Stephon Sullivan, the tight end from LSU. I mean, Colby Parkinson and Stephon Sullivan jump into a crowded tight end room, but it seems that there's somewhat some offensive versatility possible with both of those players, because they have, obviously, Sullivan was a wide receiver at LSU till 2019, and Colby Parkinson was, I mean, most of his big plays for Stanford seem to be when he split out further, split out wide more often than that. Is that versatility, are those the two biggest things that they bring to this offense, or could bring to this offense?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the initial reaction to Parkinson's selection especially was at first kind of like, what, another tight end? Especially with some good receivers still on the board. But then the more you think about it, you know, you're kind of like looking at his profile and then just like looking at how he wins, and you start to realize, like, okay, we expect him to go get this possession receiver, this big body, and like, they did it. It just isn't at receiver, you know? And so the more that I kind of thought about it that way, the more I got pretty excited about it, because they don't have a player like Parkinson. They don't have a guy with a massive catch radius who can win above the rim consistently. And, you know, even I know that some people weren't especially fond of Jimmy Graham, but his last season here has to be up there with like some of the best seasons that like a pass catcher has had with Russell Wilson. And Parkinson could do a lot of those things. But he's just, you know, he's healthier, he's quicker, he's younger. So I think that's really exciting. And then as far as Sullivan goes, you know, maybe he doesn't make the team in 2020, but, you know, probably sticks on the practice squad. And then next year, if he can kind of take over for what Hollister did, get some snaps in the slot as well, where I think he could be a legit mismatch. That's kind of exciting. He's a guy that I'm pretty interested in. I think a lot of people really excited about Thad Moss because his last name was Moss, but Sullivan was much more intriguing prospect. So I'm glad that's the direction they went. So it's a crowded tight end room, but it's a lot of like interesting skill sets. So I'm really interested to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, and Swain, I guess, kind of seems to fit the bill of he could take Tyler Lockett off kick return, punt returns, but also he puts roster pressure on John Ursa first and foremost, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. I stopped myself from doing it because it would just be insane, but I was kind of thinking about like a 53-man roster projection, and I don't think either of those two receivers make the team as far as Ursa or Swain go. But I think that is kind of his way onto the roster would be first and foremost return duty. And then, yeah, as kind of that fifth receiver who's maybe Lockett's kind of backup, not necessarily, you know, an immediate backup, but he's the guy who would fill those slot snaps if they needed it. Yeah, I'm just kind of hesitant about his agility is pretty poor. And that's really important to winning in the slot. It's kind of one of those drills that really, really translates. And it doesn't really show up on the field, and it didn't show up in testing, which is kind of worrisome. And he seems to be pretty attached to the slot. So I'm just kind of curious how that's going to work out because doesn't bode well.
No, but also he's an entire generation younger than John Ursula, though, isn't he?
Two even, I think. Is
And the other guy on offense was DJ Dallas, who seems to like the bits I saw of him and the bits I've watched of him, he kind of seems to have not a lot of breakaway speed, but he seems to have enough speed where he's not caught, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think that the way that I'd kind of put it was like he's somewhere between Rashad Penny and Chris Carson in terms of long speed, where, you know, he has that same burst as Carson at the first and second level, but he can actually kind of break the long run, which Carson has struggled with. Then obviously Penny is much more explosive. But I'm really excited about Dallas' upside. I wouldn't be at all surprised to see, you know, 2021 him be the starting running back. I wouldn't be surprised for him to play a really big role immediately as far as kind of third down and spelling Carson. I don't think Penny's going to play much of a role at all this season. I think anything that they get from him this year, I'll kind of consider a bonus. But moving forward, like my expectation is Dallas will be kind of the guy moving forward, which is awesome. It's not the direction I expect them to go at running back. I thought they were going to kind of go maybe a little bit more of a safe route, but I'm really happy with the direction they went because I think he's an exciting pick for sure.
Yeah, and the other pick they made on Saturday was Alton Robinson, a defensive end, defensive lineman from Syracuse, who, I mean, immediately popped up on the radar post-pick that when he said that he'd been working up in Bellevue with Cliff Averill at the, was it Ford Sports, the gym up there in Bellevue. But whereas Daryl Taylor is the Clem Clark pick, Robinson is kind of that revisit of the Rasheem Green. You can do inside and outside pass for us, isn't he? Or is he going to be someone who's going to stick on the outside?
Yeah, I don't know if he'll be able to play inside just because his length is a little bit short. Maybe they still do, though, just because, you know, I think the more guys that you can reduce inside, it just kind of raises the ceiling of your pass rush. But he was one that puzzled me a little bit at first, but I'm pretty excited about it. Like you mentioned, the Averill thing was really exciting to me. And then looking at his numbers, like Averill during his time in Seattle forced 14 fumbles on 34 and a half sacks, and Robinson forced 5 fumbles on 19 sacks. So they both have like a really good awareness of the football when they get to the quarterback. So I kind of just love that in terms of, I think we all really loved Averill for that. So if Robinson can translate that to the NFL, it'll be great. But I think that I'm not sure that Green will ever be able to kind of be the full-time five tech that we thought he was going to be coming out. So if Robinson can just help to add the numbers there, and maybe Green can continue to play at Leo a little bit more often, I'll be pretty happy about that because Green's functional strength just isn't really developing in the manner that I thought. But then again, he's still young, so maybe it takes another step this year.
He's still only 22, isn't he, Green?
Yeah, 22, maybe turning 23. But between... You look at all the young guys there between like Taylor, Robinson, Green, Collier, they're all guys that can kind of play up and down the defensive line to some extent. So I'm really excited to see how they kind of put all these guys because, there's a ton of versatility. You know, I think maybe you can't count on Collier for anything, but if you can, he'll be able to play 5 and 3 tech. You know, Robinson's a 5 tech. Green could theoretically play both ends, maybe even inside. I think at some point Taylor could even reduce inside in like a super fast package. So yeah, I'm really excited to see how it shakes out, because there's a lot of fun things you could do. And then if you throw Clowney in there, that's another guy who can play both end spots, reduce inside. They have a chance to be really creative on the defensive line, which is not something they had last year.
Yeah, Well, especially when the trade back up into the draft chaos occurred before they selected Stephon Sullivan, me and you were trading DMs and about, well, mixed with excitement, but also kind of giving up on the fact that Madre Harper both, I mean, it was your document which got me watching Madre Harper a few weeks ago, and obviously came in the pod a couple of weeks ago as well. That was disappointing that they didn't take him, but also pretty cool that he did end up being selected. Do you think that kind of, like we talked with Damian Lewis, playing against the Alabamas consistently and doing well against that team, do you think that kind of possibly counted against Madre Harper more than anything? Obviously, as you detail, the fit virtually every metric the Seahawks usually look for at cornerback. Do you think that lack of big game tape kind of counted against him or what?
Yeah, I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I think, like you said, we were kind of chatting about it and started to kind of sound like, okay, maybe he's not as sought after as we kind of suspected. Maybe it's just the teams who like longer corners that are going to be after him. So, you know, they started to think, okay, we can let him slide into rookie free agency and look at him there. But, you know, I'm not sure if it's the small school thing, because, and now I don't know if Heslop was their A or B, but, you know, he's playing at Stony Brook. So they did end up kind of going to that small school well, but, yeah, I'm really fascinated. I'm trying to find out kind of who was their first choice between Harper or Heslop. But yeah, I'm really curious as to what was going on with the Harper thing. Because like you said, you and I were kind of tortured at some points thinking, come on, come on, get in there. Especially when they traded back and we're like, it's got to be. So, it was a little bit of suffering. But yeah. I'm pumped that he landed in a great situation. He'll have a clear path to the roster there. So that's pretty cool.
It is kind of like comforting that Mike Mayock clearly saw something that myself and yourself saw in a player, even if it's not with an actual draft pick. That's something I'm going to go away with. But also, yeah, like I said, it is very cool that he got picked up, and he does seem to have a pretty. I mean, he probably has a clearer path in Vegas, at least in Oakland, in Vegas, than he would have here, I guess, as well, didn't he?
Yeah, I think if, you know, whether it's Heslop or somebody else who either is or isn't on the roster, whoever kind of is that developmental corner on Seattle this year is going to have to play special teams. Whereas, you know, I'm not sure how it's going to shake out in Oakland, but, you know, there's a chance that he's kind of like the immediate corner backup. Whereas in Seattle, you're kind of going to be like fifth on the depth chart. So there's a better way to kind of get on the roster in Oakland or in Las Vegas, sorry, and, you know, play sooner. So. Yeah, I think that you know, he's got awesome size and physical traits, so I'm excited to see kind of how he develops and if we were right or if we were just dead wrong.
Yeah, I mean, if we're wrong, we've got a podcast to delete and about 50 to 100 tweets to delete as well. Adam?
Testing.
There we go.
Oh my goodness, what a relief. That was about as successful as John Schneider trying to generate a sack next season, but hey, we've done it.
So what are your general thoughts on the draft class we've just gone through?
I don't really know enough about a lot of the players to kind of make some kind of hot takes. I've kind of decided that my judgment of the draft class will be on day one of the season when I see how many players are starting. And as a minimum requirement, I expect Brooks to be starting. Otherwise, I see that as a problem. And then I'll judge it again on the last day of the season when we'll see what the contributions were like. Because, you know, there's been so many wild takes going on, you know, the last few years. But I think ultimately you can look at last season and think, well, you know, we really could have used LJ Collier. And the year before, you could say, yeah, we really could have used Rashad Penny to have contributed more. And I don't think we've extracted enough from the previous 2-3 draft classes that we probably needed to make the step, especially in a time of rebuild. My gut thought is that picks 1, 2, and 3 could have been made with picks 2, 3, and 4. And they probably overdrafted, but that's what they like to do and whatever. I'm not going to quibble with that. And I mean, I don't think the roster is better at the minute than it was last year, just because of the general lack of a stud pass rusher, which leaves me slightly concerned. But I feel like I can see what they're trying to do. I just think if you'd asked me 3 years ago when they were going to start the rebuild, if I'd be happy with where they are right now, I think probably not is the answer. But maybe I don't know enough about a lot of the players to make that point. I don't know if you agree with that or not, Alistair.
Yeah, I think I'm maybe just a little bit higher. I mean, I absolutely agree and admire your decision just to wait to judge the draft class, because I think everybody would just be better off if everybody just waited. I'm pretty excited about the direction the roster is going. And I have said this previously, where it's just kind of like I'm just operating completely under the assumption that whether it's Clowney, Everson Griffin, somebody else, they're going to sign somebody. Like, I just almost like refuse to analyze it through any other lens, because I just find it... I find it impossible to imagine that they enter the season without him. If they do, then I'll kind of be closer to your stance, because they really are lacking that lead guy. I'm really excited about kind of Daryl Taylor's immediate future, but you know, if they're going into the season with the edge group they have, I'll be really concerned. They do need to add somebody, but I'll be shocked if they don't, kind of thing.
Yeah,
it's worth pointing out that one of my best mates is called Daryl Taylor, and he does not look anything like Daryl Taylor that we drafted. So I'm having a hard time in kind of visualizing a guy with that name being destructive against an NFL offensive line. So maybe that's in part what's skewing my views on it ever so slightly.
So you mentioned Heslop. Any other undrafted names that popped to you, or ones names you're going to watch out for in whatever form of preseason or training camp we get in the coming weeks and months?
That's kind of my next step here, is to get a better hold of the UDFA class and start to kind of dig through it. Definitely Heslop's at the top of the list. And then, you know, your head immediately goes to Anthony Gordon, just because if you can get a backup QB to play behind, like we said, most durable player in the NFL, essentially, for as cheap as you possibly can get, like, that's great to me. I'm a fan of Geno Smith. I felt good with him being the backup, but... I don't think that they downgraded all that much of it's Gordon. And yeah, just it's literally as cheap as it gets. So it's hard to complain about that. And I think it'll be a ton of fun to watch in preseason. So that's one I'm excited about, just through, you know, entertainment. It's going to be great. I didn't enjoy watching Paxton Lynch play last August, but I'm sure I'll enjoy Anthony Gordon if there's stuff to watch this August.
Yeah. But also, I mean, it's hard to be more productive than he was at Wazoo last year as well. I mean, he's coming in, as you say, as cheap as cheap can be. And yeah, for that position, and he's come off a year where he was, what was it, 58 touchdowns or whatever stupid he threw for Washington State Cougars. Are you surprised that they didn't dip? I mean, we talked about Colby and Stephon Sullivan maybe doing a bit of tight end wide receiver meshing, but are you surprised that they didn't dip into the best ever wide receiver class at all with their 7, 8, 9 picks?
You know, if you'd asked me, you know, ahead of the draft.
No, not at all, obviously, because they got Swain, but possibly earlier and more, they were more aggressive with the group.
Yeah, no, if you had said that, you know, if you said after the draft was over, hey, Seattle drafted one receiver and is a slot receiver in the sixth round, I would be shocked and pretty annoyed, knowing that, like, you know, they didn't draft a receiver, but they drafted Coley Parkinson. I would be a little bit more on board, because I just think that he can kind of do those possession receiver things. And, you know, I think there's maybe 10 different ways this draft shakes out. And in maybe 6 of them, they do end up drafting a receiver, maybe as early as day 2. I think things change for them. I also kind of suspect that they were hoping a team would come in for David Moore when David Moore had that tender applied, and that they'd get an extra 7th round pick for him. I think they were kind of okay to move on from him. And then with him on the roster, maybe it becomes less urgent just by way of numbers. But, you know, there's a couple players on the receiver depth chart, one specifically that I'm not as high on as everybody else. But there are still a couple intriguing guys behind everybody. You know, I'm really excited about Penny Hart. I hope that there's a full preseason, because I think Penny Hart can make a legitimate roster push, and he'd be a ton of fun to watch in preseason, especially playing with Anthony Gordon. And I think he could do a lot of fun things. And, you know, I'm kind of counting on him to make the roster, and he's somebody who I think can make plays. So, yeah, I guess, you know, their pass catching group is deep. maybe just the receiver group is not, you know? But you're playing a risky game. If all of a sudden, you know, it's week four and Olsen and Disley are both carrying serious injuries, then all of a sudden it's not looking so smart, you know?
Yeah. So 24 hours after the draft, the 2020 offseason really kicked up into a gear, and the Seahawks started to make some, give themselves some breathing room with DJ Fluker and then Justin Britt both being released. Neither kind of, well, Fluker probably was the more surprising one, Adam, of the two, but it's clearly for something more than a rainy day, isn't it, those two moves?
Well, you'd think so, but I mean, that rainy day may have already passed. You know, I would have hoped that that would have been like, you know, we're going to do this so we can sign Clowney. I know that's probably reductive thinking, but there's not that many players that you're thinking, wow, I really want to go and spunk $15 million a year on them anymore that are left out there. You have to assume there's a plan in place as opposed to just cutting players in order to have some money in case something happens. But, it kind of seems like it's, I know that Everson Griffin is an option, but he's 33. He's not going to be a Ziggy Ansah, but you don't know what necessarily you're going to get from him as a, you know, three down guy. I don't know. I mean, were these cuts available to be made months ago to save the same amount of money, or did it only kick in now?
I think Fluker is definitely, it's Damian Lewis, isn't it? That's the reason for the Fluker release, Hollister.
I think so. I mean, to tell you the truth, I felt really bad because, you know, the draft had finished and my girlfriend's excited because I'm like back in her life, and then, you know, we're about to go do something on Sunday afternoon, and then I'm like, oh my gosh, two pieces of news just came in that we've basically been anticipating for 3.5 months now. Like, I kind of figured that Fluker was always a part of their plan to free up more money. And like you said, it got a lot easier once Lewis got there. But no, when it was first Fluker, you thought, okay, maybe, you know, maybe they're just doing him a solid because he's such a good teammate, such a good, like, lock guy. You know, you're not going to be our starter. You're probably not going to make the team. Go find a better spot. But then that Britt news comes in, and you're like, whoa, okay, so that's not just $3.5 million you're freeing up. You're freeing up, like, legitimate money to do stuff. You know, obviously they also needed a couple roster spots to add a few more UDFAs, but, like, I mean, you're not making these moves all of a sudden just for that. So I think that, you know, there's going to be a corresponding move, but that it hasn't happened immediately, maybe that wasn't the exact reason. But no, I thought it was really curious timing. Especially, you know, Britt was waived with the failed physical designation, so it wasn't even like they were waiting for him to pass a physical because he couldn't. So, it's very odd timing. I don't know that I don't think it really affects their offensive line for 2020 because I don't think either of those players were starters on what would be the best version of their line. But no, the timing left me scratching my head for sure.
Yeah, I mean, with Britt, with someone who was a relative, I mean, he wasn't me, he was a comfortable starter for the team, and with the draft class around him, he was a relative success as a draft pick as well. It's I mean, I know the NFL is a cold business, as people say, but releasing him with that failed designation, physical designation, now he can't go anywhere for the next few months, is quite a cold move for someone who was so important and clearly so close to the most important player on the roster, Adam.
Yeah, it just seems like a bizarre kind of, it's almost like a news dump. Like, oh, we'll just sneak away the news that we're just cutting our right guard and our starting center. But the way in which they did it, you're right. The fluke of idea made sense. You know, give him the time to go and do what he wants and go and get another team. And pleased for him, he's a Raven, and I imagine that will work out particularly well for him given their style of offense. But the Britt thing does seem a bit odd. And I mean, I don't know if you guys would categorize KJ Wright in the same sphere. Obviously, he's probably a better and more useful player. But I'm kind of thinking that if they're doing like this money dump and you have just signed, you know, a linebacker with your first round pick, is there an argument that, you know, go the whole hog and get rid of KJ Wright as well, you know, as another guy that could bring in a lot of money with a cut?
Alistair?
Yeah, to be honest, I hadn't really considered that possibility. But yeah, I think there's probably an argument to be made there. I think that even, you know, if Brooks is playing, say, half, 60% of the snaps, you know, you're going to get some extra speed there. But like we were saying earlier, I think there's an argument that maybe Barton isn't as good of a player as KJ Wright is right now, but he brings significantly more athleticism in the field, which is something they need. You know, the speed to go sideline to sideline is something they need. I don't know if they need maybe the extra money that Wright's cut would free up right now. If I had it my way, they'd kind of do what they needed to do just to sign Clowney and Griffin and just double down and have a deep defensive line rotation. I don't think they'll do that. And so maybe they don't need to cut Wright. But that's somebody who, you know, if we're making the argument that the decision to release Britt right now is a bit of a cold move, I don't know if it would be the same for Wright, but he's somebody that I don't care that it's a business. He's somebody that I would want to see them do kind of the right thing for, because he's just been such an amazing underrated Seahawk for so long. I think that he kind of deserves the right goodbye, however that happens, you know?
I almost feel bad like categorizing him in the same thing, but you're either going to be like cold arseholes or you're not, like in all capacity. And I kind of feel like, well, yeah, as you say, just get rid of all of them and give me Clowney and Griffin, and then you're better.
I agree. But also, Adam, we've talked several times on this pod about how that generation of players, obviously Sherm, Earl, Cam, Averill, Bennett. I mean, the list is relative. Doug Baldwin, probably he's in that category as well. The players, which are so important to the success that this team had in the earlier part of this decade, the last decade, but they never got that farewell. That KJ Wright, Bobby, they're probably the last two opportunities for that, which are probably coming in the next 3, 4, 5 years, aren't they, Alistair?
Yeah, that was kind of, as I was, I don't want to say talking myself into the Brooks pick, because I think that's kind of unfair to him. I think he does it plenty enough, but that was the one thing that I still to this kind of moment, I still can't get past, is the fact that I think in the long term, Brooks's like ceiling is with Wagner gone, just because I think his long-term ceiling and best fit is in the middle. Him and Wagner as kind of the two core linebackers, there just isn't enough, at least in my opinion, downfield athleticism, the ability to kind of cover. I don't think that maybe Brooks is as bad of a cover linebacker as the gut reaction was. I think he showed a lot more positive things in 2018 than he did last year. But yeah, I think that, you know, if it's 2 years, 3 years from now, I don't think Wagner is necessarily long for Seattle anymore, which is, that's a crazy thing to think about, because I really enjoy kind of thinking back on those amazing Seahawk teams and almost like assigning labels, where it's like, you know, Doug Baldwin is the heart, like Russell Wilson was the most important, like Sherm was the mouthpiece. But at the end, like for me, Bobby Wagner was the best player. Like when we look back on that, Bobby Wagner will be, I think he played his position better than any other Seahawk ever played their position while they were here. And that he's not going to kind of be the lifelong Seahawk, the guy who has 54 retired like immediately after he's done playing. That's a really weird reality to consider, but I think all of a sudden it became a lot more likely, which I mean, as recently as last year, like he literally was I've never seen a Seahawk play as good as he played during 2017 and 2018. So to all of a sudden now be considering his future is just bizarre. And it's still kind of, maybe it's a little bit of overreaction, but it's just, it's a very difficult thing for me to consider, just because it seemed impossible quite recently.
Adam?
Yeah, I mean, the amazing thing to kind of go back to the, I feel like I'm being a real bad cop here on today's show, which is not really the way I like to be, but the amazing thing is like all of those players are going to end up giving us one third round comp pick and a fifth round pick for Michael Bennett's trade. I don't think anyone else is going to bring anything in like that whole generation of amazing players. And I think that's one of my biggest frustrations of kind of the rebuild that they've undergone over the last few years. That they had so much that they could have given up, that it just kind of felt like they like pettied their way out of so much potential capital to make the team better. And I think I'm frustrated because I don't see the fun in the team that I really wanted to see by now. I mean, this is all like nonsense. It's so far away from X's and O's and actual statistic, anything of interest apart from just like a fan's gut reaction. But as a fan, I just don't see the fun that I would have hoped to have had by now. And so, you know, as the players get older, you're going to get less and less for them. And I just worry that, again, that we're almost in like a first class version of Jeff Fisher's purgatory. Like we're not a 7-9 team, obviously, but we're an 11-5 team that's not going to be good enough to really get over the hump. And that's what worries me going into this season. It's going to be another year like the last two that obviously loads of fan bases would cut their arm off for. But I kind of feel we have the right to demand better now, because you have your once-in-generation quarterback. We probably in our lives won't see a better quarterback for Seattle. And I think now's the time to start demanding more. And I'm not quite sure we're going to get the bang for the buck.
Yeah. Alistair?
Yeah, I think they have kind of maybe started to learn a little bit more from, like we were saying, the Chancellor contracts, the Baldwin contracts, the Averill deal, where you're all of a sudden stuck with dead money because you commit really long term and all of a sudden, you know, they can't fulfill that contract. So I think they're learning, but I think they're turning a corner. You know, I wasn't very convinced by the 2018 team, but I was a lot more convinced by last year's team, which seems weird. Because I think by all accounts, people seem more frustrated with the team last year than 2 years ago. But I mean, I'm getting to the point where I think the offense, it's almost like, you know, those Saints teams of like 5 years ago, where the offense is so high powered that it's like, just get the defense to a place of good enough, and the offense will be able to win them games. And I think they're kind of getting there, but I think the defense has a really high ceiling. I think the secondary is going to be really good this year. It's kind of a group that I'm really excited about. And, you know, I think the linebackers, I think the linebackers are going to be put in a better position. I don't think that Wagner is aging as much as maybe people think that he is. And, you know, I think a lot of blame is placed on him and KJ Wright for the coverage woes, where, you know, I think it was more about them being put in a poor position. There's extra speed there. I think the defensive line is just deeper this year. Again, going back to, you know, assumption they're going to add one more piece, but even then they have a deep rotation there. You know, if the defense is a top 10 unit in 2020, I won't be surprised at all. And then, you know, I think the offense has the capability of being the best offense of the league. Will it? Maybe not, because, you know, Kansas City exists, Baltimore exists, but it's going to be right there with the best of them. If you have an elite defense and like a good to great defense, or sorry, an elite offense and a good to great defense, I mean, you're talking about a really, really good team. So I think that, you know, they came through kind of a refresh, a rebuild with two playoff berths and, you know, a Blair Walsh missed field goal away from three playoff berths. And I think 2020, it's going to ramp up big time. And that's kind of where I, you know, people are raging against this notion of trading a first round pick for, you know, Ngakoue, Chris Jones, whoever it may be, raging against the idea of doing that to extend him because it's not good value. I don't really have a huge problem with it because they need that player. And with that player, they can contend. And so I don't care about that. You know, how do you say in one breath, they're not doing enough to win around Russell Wilson, then in the same breath saying, oh, but don't trade a first round pick to get a pass rusher? Why not just go all in? I don't really care about the value. Did the Bears get better by trading for Khalil Mack? Yes. I don't care what the picks ended up being. I don't care that Mitch Trubisky is weighing that Bears franchise down. Khalil Mack made them better. And so, you know, you get better with talent. It's just like, I think we get so overblown with kind of value of things sometimes. It's even like the Christian McCaffrey deal. Is it a lot to get a running back? Sure. Are the Panthers better with McCaffrey? Yeah, absolutely. So I'm not going to rage against them giving like this transcendent offensive player a contract. And it's the same thing. I wouldn't rage against them giving a first round pick and a big contract for a guy who's going to give them 10 sacks when they really need 10 sacks. When 10 sacks is the difference between a good defense and a great defense. I just think we get so hung up on the value sometimes where, you know, it just comes back to a question of, is your team better for this? Yes, then do it. It's that simple. And at least for me, it's that simple.
Does that make you feel any better, Adam?
I think so. I guess the point that will overhang and underpin all of that is, are the offense going to be allowed to be put in a position like Sean Payton gives his offense of saying, okay, go out and be a top five offense, because we know they can do it. But there will always be the question, even with, you know, I did think the offense made huge strides last year under Schottenheimer, but, you know, Pete Carroll is going to have to have some kind of philosophical change to allow his offense to be a Saints, a Chiefs, which is doubly frustrating, because I agree. I certainly think they can be that if they're allowed to do it.
Yeah. Obviously, the one main major name hanging over all of that, all of the hope and the ceiling for the 2020 Seahawks is Clowney. He's still out there, he's still unsigned. He doesn't seem to be in much of a rush to get signed, even though the comp pick formula is now effectively switched off for the year. One sign towards that is that Jaron Reed has gone back to his pre-Clowney number of 90. Is that a smoke signal, or is that just the smartest business move a Seahawks player has made this offseason? He knows if Clowney is signed, he's going to get even more money for number 90 than he did last offseason, Alistair.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. It doesn't really move the needle much for me. You know, I think that it was still kind of like a 50-50 proposition before, and it's still a 50-50 proposition. So I'm not too hung up on the Reed news.
Yeah, and if obviously Clowney or Hunter or AN other on the defensive line, what other positions do you think they could try and address with if they do use the Britt Fluker release money? What is like nickel corner maybe, or another body at running back? That seems to be top of the list of possibilities from my end. Who or where do you think they also look to with this bit of spare cash they now have?
Yeah, I'm not sure like if there's a player out there that can justify the money that they have, or like taking a fair chunk of it, but I think defensive tackle is kind of their biggest glaring need right now outside of that spot. You know, I think Al Woods gave them a lot last year. And I don't think I have complete faith that they'll sign that player, because they're always pretty clever when it comes to signing that veteran defensive tackle who plays a fair bit. You know, I think you know, the big name left out there would be Mike Daniels, but he looked so old last year playing for Detroit. And I think he has like foot injuries now, which always worries you with bigger guys, just because like that's a lot of kind of stress on it, a lot of pressure. But if he's a guy who's suddenly healthy, I think he can make a big difference. But all of a sudden, they've shown a really good kind of understanding of the type of defensive tackle they need in the division. Like Woods was so good defending laterally, and that's what you need to do against the Niners and the Rams, like stretch running games. So I'm not kind of sure who's the best fit there, but defensive tackle is the spot that I think they need to add like a legitimate difference maker for sure. Who that is, I just don't know yet.
Yeah, Adam, anything else on the current state of the Seahawks?
I definitely agree with what Alistair said there. I guess the only other position I think maybe they need to look at, which is injury and fitness pending, is I'm slightly worried about the top end quality of the running back room if Carson and Penny aren't going to come back like healthy to start the season. I can't really think of anyone that's out there. You know, someone like Devonta Freeman's a great fantasy name, but you know, in reality, he's probably a broken human being. But I think that slightly concerns me if Penny and Carson aren't going to be raring to go at the start of the season, what they might do if they're going to look to lean on the running game so heavily.
I mean, CJ Prosize is still available, isn't he?
Now we're talking.
One more thing.
Am I missing anyone there, Alistair, or not?
Sorry?
Am I missing anyone there or not?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I definitely think they could do to add a player, just, you know, in case Carson's not ready. Maybe a guy like Isaiah Crowell. Like, he's not very exciting, but if you're going to give him kind of the inside touches, give Travis Homer the outside touches, maybe you can manufacture something. But yeah, I think that it's definitely maybe a cause for concern if Carson's not healthy.
Did we sign him? Was that just...
I think it was just interest, but I mean, he would make sense. I'd be all for it.
Yeah. One other thing, which is obviously, it's a massive help with cable fans, but Russell Wilson is social media game. Adam I'm not sure if it's a joy to behold or something to kind of like hopefully ignore and it goes away. Adam.
It's one of the great in the bin candidates. I have to say, but you know. The Russell Wilson persona of 2019-2020 is working for him, and good luck to him if that's what's going through, and that's what's making him happy. They think good luck to him because it's working and he looks happy.
that's quite a nice little segue into this week's Get in the Bin, shall we, Adam? So this week, Alistair, I prepped you a few hours ago. Do you want to kick things off? Who's your nomination to Get in the Bin? And as I told you, Colin Cowherd does have a lifetime residency in this particular segment, Alistair.
Yeah, no, he's I think that's a correct placement for him. I would just put like a group of people there, and that's just the people who are crowning Ursua still. I'm prepared to eat crow on this. I'm really prepared to eat crow on this, but I just can't get past it. If he was so good, why didn't he see the field as a 25-year-old rookie? If he was so good, why didn't he take over when David Moore got hurt in August? If he was so good, why did the Seahawks feel the need to get Josh Gordon? If he was so good, why didn't he see the field after Josh Gordon got suspended? If he was so good, why did they have to sign another receiver in free agency? Like, we got a lot of signs pointing to the fact that he's not any good, and he's now 26 years old. So if I see another Doug Baldwin comparison thrown out there, I'm going to lose my mind because it's just so disrespectful. And then within 6 hours of Freddie Swain getting trapped on Saturday, I saw somebody throw a Tyler Lockett comparison out there, and it just made me want to bash my head against the wall because it's just so disrespectful. I'm prepared to eat crow, but I don't think I'm going to because I don't think John Ursua is any good. So we need to put all of the John Ursua hype in the bin. That's what we need to do.
So I agree. I don't really understand it because, as you say, he didn't show any reason to be hyped about him. But why do you think he lasted the season and Greg Jennings didn't?
I mean, that might end up being part of why I end up beating crow on this, because clearly they saw something. I have no idea. I'm just shocked that they felt that they couldn't put him on the practice squad, that somebody would scoop him up. Yeah. But you know, if he takes a jump between 25 years old and 26 years old, good for him. If I was a betting man, I would bet that Penny Hart takes his roster spot this year. But yeah, I'm not anticipating a big jump. I'm so sick of hearing John Ursua as a reason not to pursue a wide receiver, because it's just absurd.
But also, maybe John Ursua and Gary Jennings are why they didn't, because, as you say, they didn't really attribute anything to the team of rookie. Maybe that's why they sat this wide receiver class out. Adam?
My first one, I think maybe we can do a couple of rounds of this. My first one actually does go out to Jaron Reed, who tweets out today that he's taking number 90, which causes you have to watch the Silks for like 2 seconds to appreciate why that is obviously a story. And then comes out that half an hour and says, hey, I know it's not news, but it's true. I didn't want to make it a big deal. It's like, well, if that's the case, don't tweet about it. Just an annoying thing to do. And his kind of social media is slightly questionable anyway in the last year or so. But I just thought it was a bit you know what you're doing, mate. And now either own what you're trying to do or don't do it at all. But don't kind of back off. Albeit, I did say that it was a bin-worthy decision from Clowney to go from 91 to 90.
But yeah.
Clowney at 91 would be the most sensational-looking jersey. And I thought 90 ruined it a little bit. But hey, that's me. But my first bin.
Okay, well, mine is going to be, well, I've got four. I'm going to go, because we talked about earlier with Britt and Fluka's release. The people on Facebook and Twitter more prominently, is the word I'll use, celebrating the cuts, particularly of Justin Britt. I mean, on Facebook and on Twitter, I saw the phrase that they could not be happier that Justin Britt had lost his job. And when we talk about, the Seahawks can't draft, Seahawks can't do this in the draft, they've wasted this on the airline, wasted that. Justin Britt was a draft pick which panned out. I mean, was he a third round pick or late second if he was a second round pick? And he was an important part of the Seahawks, as we said earlier, about the transition from the team which was loaded and in the conference games for a few years and in the top five of power rankings, for as meaningless as they may be. But he was a key part of that transition. And to celebrate a guy losing his job, and as we said earlier, he can't immediately go out and get one. Not, obviously, he's in financial need of one, but he can't continue his career. And to celebrate that is just kind of tacky, but also somewhat unsurprising, Alistair.
Unsurprising is the correct word to use there. Yeah, I mean, I think maybe the Seahawks will have improved upon his position, but anytime people are celebrating players losing their jobs, it's just kind of gross to me. Yeah, and then to use the defense, they're millionaires, I think they're going to be okay. That doesn't really make up for the fact that you're losing a job and losing these relationships you've fostered for 6 years. It's kind of gross to me.
Yeah, Adam?
I thought another one was with the success of the NFL draft and the way in which everyone was just able to be at home, do their work, mind their own business. I kind of thought it was a shot in the bin for the first one in the facility and the last one out. You know, if you're not working 28 hours a day, you don't really care about the NFL. I thought it was, and even John Lynch, I think, said afterwards, the value of the work-life balance. I think he said he's going to send the scouts home 2 weeks next year. And the onus is on you to get your work done. And Yeah, there's such a machismo, faux machismo, in the NFL about how hard you work. And I do love it when you see a young player is criticized because they may not be the first one in the facility, which is just such an asinine thing to talk about in 2020. But I thought that the success of the way in which it worked, everyone being at home and chilling and having their kids there, which I just thought was really lovely.
Yeah.
I thought it was a bit of a shot in the eye, this idea that if you want to be a success in the NFL, thou shalt not have any other life. Breathing is wasting time from grinding tape with your sixth round offensive guard.
Yeah, my other was on the ESPN coverage. I mean, every single draft pick, every one of the 255, they used his draft pick to pitch a Lifetime movie, didn't they, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, one of them. I think everyone can probably think of their favorite one, but I think Schefter tweeted out about a player that signed for the Seals, an undrafted free agent. I can't remember the guy's name, but let's just say he was called Gary Jones. Like, Gary Jones, who was recovering from being shot in the face and could have been a sixth round draft for signing with the Seals. Like, who gives a fuck about it? It doesn't make a blind bit of difference. And let's be honest, there was a very heavily weighted demographic on all of these players. They were talking about these the problems in their life they were having. Didn't exactly dispel some of the connotations that are probably existing in the NFL. And I just thought that they just did a terrible job with that. Like, his entire family got burned in a chemical fire, but he ran a 4.32 coming out of like, what are you talking about? This has nothing to the, like, the colour and texture of what we're looking for in players. I thought it was horrendous. I think our friend Mike Dugard commented on that on their podcast on it was unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, it was too much, wasn't it, Alistair?
It was so bad. It was so bad. Yeah, it was every single selection, and then you're just like, okay, so now I really need to root for these guys. Like, I'm not sure what it was supposed to add. I'm Team NFL Network till I die. And this year we were kind of forced to watch the ESPN broadcast, and it was like, oh, I haven't missed anything in the past 10 years of me watching NFL Network instead.
Yeah, but saying that, the best thing on the ESPN thing was the NFL Network analyst in Daniel Jeremiah.
Absolutely.
He was brilliant.
He was fantastic. He always is. He's so good. I mean, I miss Mike Mayock, but Jeremiah's, he's so, so good at what he does.
Yeah, and one more thing, nomination for me is everyone trying to drag Aaron Rodgers through the mud for a reaction he's yet to give on the Packers just completely having a brain melt and picking a backup quarterback, a backup running back, and a fullback with their first three picks in the draft. But obviously the big one is Jordan Love. I mean, it's almost like the media darling Brett Favre is still holding weight, and how he reacted and how he reacted to Brett Favre not doing him the duty a decade ago. He's still being hard against Rodgers, who's clearly a bit of a unique individual, but I mean, it's a bit much, isn't it? How Aaron Rodgers is doing this, he's doing that, he's not this, he's not that. I mean, Brett Favre has added to that, I think, tonight as well. But I mean, no one knows how Aaron Rodgers is going to react. Everyone who played with him, like James Jones, James Jones is the most prominent one. I think Jamarcus Finley tweeted something out saying that, look, Rodgers is not going to do that. Rodgers is going to be this and that. But still, the narrative is written in stone, isn't it, on Aaron Rodgers, Alistair?
Yeah, people like immediately wanted to say, oh yeah, Rodgers is going to hate this guy, he's going to be so mean to him, and it's a hilarious thing to imagine. But no, I think you nailed it. There's this narrative already formed that he's gonna torture Love, and it just is ridiculous. And you know, I know Joe Flacco got like a lot of pushback for this in 2018, but I think he said something along the lines of like, it's not my job to mentor Lamar Jackson. And like, it's, you know, he's an ass, and you know, maybe don't say that, but he's not wrong. Like, he's trying to win his job and hold him off. It's not Aaron Rodgers' job to like mentor Jordan Love and make him into this amazing quarterback. So no, I agree with that completely. And I think there's something too, like, this is going to spark a fire under Rodgers.
Yeah. But also I think Ben Roethlisberger said the same when Mason Rudolph was drafted in the third or fourth round for the Steelers. And as it proven, Ben Roethlisberger clearly knew more about Mason Rudolph than we all did. So he was kind of proven right on that one. Adam, Rodgers, Jordan Love?
Well, I do think Rodgers is a grade A bell end. I mean, I think that is almost beyond doubt. And, you know, the way in which he doesn't strike me as a guy necessarily that's going to give his all to help the guy that's kind of been brought to take his job. But, yeah, I mean, it must be very difficult as an elite athlete to basically have the clock start, like, you know, the sand clock on your career basically tipped upside down and watching the granules start to fall for the first time, because ultimately that's what they've done. They said you've got 2 years really until you're not going to be our quarterback unless something dramatic happens. So
yeah,
I do kind of feel for him. But I mean, I think some of the stuff about, like, you know, Rodgers has thrown one touchdown to a first round pick, I think is a little bit of a selective statistic.
Yeah, because with
like every second half they've ever had has been like a wide receiver this year, so they've done that. I do think it's quite funny about Joe Flacco thing about Lamar Jackson, because I'm trying to think if there's a single thing that Joe Flacco can teach Lamar Jackson, given their various skill sets, about what either of them could learn from the other. And I'm really apart from talking, I can't believe anything that the two of them could do that would be remotely similar under center.
I mean, Joe Flacco could probably reach higher in the shelf and, like, on top of things. I mean, he's surely taller than Lamar. Lamar's, I don't know how tall Lamar is, but yeah, I mean, outside of that, Jordan Love, AJ Dillon, and the tight end, I can't remember his name. It's a strange way to approach the draft when it was quite clear what was holding back the Packers, wasn't it? So as the AFC rival, it's quite funny, isn't it, Alistair?
Yeah, I do kind of agree with that notion that it's a selective statistic, though, because it's like, you know, if they didn't hit on Jordy Nelson, they probably would have gone and found another receiver. They didn't hit on Randall Cobb, they would have done the same. Devontae Adams, like, just because they didn't take a first-round wide receiver doesn't mean they haven't had hits previously. You know, and I do think maybe Rodgers needs to do, he could do a better job of kind of working with what he's got, because they have invested. There are some fun players there. I think Marquez Valdez Scantling is a really fun player. You know, EQ St. Brown, they have receivers there. Just maybe the onus is a little bit on Rodgers to work with what he's got. But if it is a power move by LaFleur, it's an all-time weird power move.
Yeah, but also it's not Marquez Valdez Scantling, as Joe Tessitore showed us. It is just MVS.
Oh, right.
That's the only way you have to refer to him. As anything else, Adam? Apart from a new microphone.
Yeah, apart from a new microphone, which is very much physically in the bin, ironically. No, I think that's about it. I mean, just to continue the Rodgers thing, because I do find it a fascinating subject, and stuff like this happens. You know, when you watch the way in which Rodgers can be so dismissive facially of some of his receivers, I wonder if that's the kind of thing that a lot of the, like, GM were looking at thinking, do you know what? The biggest capital I've got, do I really want to use it on someone that Rodgers might just not like and never throw to again? So I may as well just spend, I mean, ironically, it comes to a replacement instead of someone else, but if I would be so scared of what Rodgers could do to someone's confidence that I might think I'm going defense all the way, because I don't want to piss the guy off.
Yeah, it's just like their first. I mean, AJ Dillon, Aaron Jones scored about 4,000 top touchdowns last year, so they went and got someone to, I don't know, take the ball out of his hands. It was a very strange draft. It wasn't just a Jordan Love pick. Alistair, where can people get in touch with you and follow you? You've had a promotion up in Field Goals Towers, haven't you, since last time we spoke?
Yeah. Now deputy editor now. And so just helping kind of our staff run the day-to-day there. So can still find me at Field Goals. I'm going to be trying to pump out some more draft content over the next few weeks here. And then we'll hit a dead point. But yeah, it's been great. Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, no, massively do appreciate you taking the time to jump on and barely be able to hear Adam for about an hour. So, but if people can get involved with the podcast, they can. We are doing a thing. Well, I've done one. I'm doing one again the next couple of days where we're rewatching certain games handpicked by myself from the 2013 season, just having kind of like a weird kind of watch along, just hear us talk through the games. We've done one which was the Houston Texans game, and that was a remarkable win, watching it 7 years later. So that'll be coming in the next few weeks. But one thing, what with that, as I said, that rewatching that team is incredible amount of fun. I mean, Marshawn Lynch is Marshawn Lynch, Richard Sherman. You have Richard Sherman against Andre Johnson in that Texans game. JJ Watt was at the height of his powers. It is quite weird when you jump back and watch that team with like 20/20 eyes, as it were.
Yeah, that's that game was amazing, especially just because, like, I think entering that game, you thought, hey, maybe this team is, you know, kind of invincible, and then they fall behind, and then they come back, and you're like, oh, this team is absolutely invincible, and that game was awesome.
Yeah, but yeah, until next time, this has been the Pedestrian Podcast.
Oh.
Hey, is this Jordan?
Yes, sir.
Hey, Jordan, this is John Schneider. I'm the general manager of the Seattle Seahawks.
Yes, sir. How you doing?
Hey, did you say Bobby Wagner was the guy you looked up to in your interview?
Oh, yeah.
Are you cool if we select you right here at 27?
I'm more than cool with it.
Dude, we're really excited, man. Bring that toughness and that grit and all that speed, brother.
Yes, sir.
Okay.